welcome listeners to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer. I'm Jeff Pedro in with Mark Avery. I'm glad to be back in the saddle. I've been out for quite a few weeks and very excited to be here today.
And we're glad you're back.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah. Thank you. And if you'd like to get on the show today, be sure to give us a call at 457-1290. That's 457-1290. And I want to start off the show today because I'm obviously, like I mentioned earlier, very glad to be back here. But part of that reason is that over the last several weeks, I've gotten plenty of fuel for discussion, and I'm sure that will be items of interest to our listeners. And I want to start off with an incident that I just want to bring to a level of conscious awareness some of the things that are going on. First of all, many of you may have heard in the last week, I believe it was last Tuesday, an 87-year-old man was attacked, assaulted, robbed, violently beaten in Chicago, of all places, by three youthful individuals who robbed him, took his money, and left him for dead. And it got a little bit of attention in the first day or two, and I imagine there'll be some patriotic people, since he was a World War II veteran, who might still bring that up in the news. But for the most part, it was kind of pushed on the back burner. And I thought it was quite ironic that the mayor of Chicago chose to come out with a public statement about how Chick-fil-A does not represent Chicago's values over an issue involving the marriage amendment, and he thought that was more important to comment on than this incident that occurred right in his own city, or the fact that Chicago's increasingly violent, or the increasing violence in the city of Chicago, which, by the way, is, according to recent statistics, twice that as occurring in Mexico City, and almost the highest escalating rate in the state of, in the country, except for maybe New York City and Los Angeles, California. He chose to address that other issue instead of something that's obviously much more relevant. And I find that quite ironic, especially since that particular incident, the robbery and beating of the 87-year-old World War II veteran, I would argue, based on the facts that we know, was at least as significant as the circumstances that have been so widely reported down in Florida. Now, I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about that because we've talked about that and we're still waiting for the facts to be known. But I'm just wondering, why aren't certain other interest groups weighing in on this particular act? And I ask you, the listeners, to give some thought to that. And it was a violent act. And I want to just throw out there, let's say, for example, just for purposes of discussion today, let's say in the city of Chicago, where they don't, they have very strict gun control laws.
And in fact, in Chicago and in all of Illinois, there is no legal concealed carry. There's no way to get a license, and there's no legal way, unless you're an elected official, or like an alderman of the city of Chicago, there's no way for you to legally carry a firearm for self-defense.
Yeah, I wonder how this incident would have been reported, and the magnitude of which it would have reported, if the 87-year-old man would have pulled a gun and shot and killed or seriously injured one, two, or all three of his assailants. I really wonder, just on those facts alone, based on what we know, how the incident would have been reported. Three offenders, 115, 118, 121, I believe. I know one was a juvenile and the other two were young adults, assaulted an 87-year-old helpless man who I think walks around with crutches or with a cane and a walker, and robbed him. And I just wonder how the incident would have been reported had that 87-year-old man, knowing that the growing violence in Chicago obviously exposes him to increased likelihood that he's going to be victimized, decided, I'm going to go get me a gun. I'm going to carry it in my pocket, and if it happens to me, I'm going to shoot him. And he did that. I just wonder what the outcome would be.
That's not too terribly different from Otis McDonald, who lives in Chicago and wanted to have a firearm for his self-defense in his home because so many homes in his area had been broken into and people had been robbed. That's a very, very clear parallel to where this particular case is, where this guy did not have a gun, but had he had a gun, it would have been a very different situation.
And the gun would have been the equalizer, because let's face it, I saw the interview, and if you just, and all I did is I put a keyword search, 87-year-old man assaulted in Chicago, and I found not only the article, but they have a interview. One of the local news media went to his house, interviewed him and his daughter, and you see him sitting in his chair with his face all bloodied and his cheeks all swollen, and you could tell he didn't have much of a chance at all against one, let alone three attackers. But with the gun, it could have changed the pace. And yet in a city where violence occurs at increasingly higher rates every day, they make the decision that they want stricter gun laws instead of allowing citizens the ability to carry guns and defend themselves in situations like this. And I just wonder how it would have been reported, what the perspective would have been had that particular individual had a gun and used the gun and shot one, two, or all three of the assailants, and then there would have been a different story to tell. And I have my own opinions about that. I want to throw that out to the listeners, and maybe we'll engage in some hearty dialogue about issues like that. But this whole concept of self-defense is driving individuals' desire to learn about guns, to get a gun for personal protection, to carry a gun on them wherever they go, certainly to keep a gun in their home. We have people coming down to the range on a regular basis who they themselves say, I've never thought I'd have been in this situation 5, 10, 15 years ago, but the world's changed, and it has changed. And we have to face the reality. We have to get our heads out of the sand. The world has changed. Incidents of the recent past and throughout the last 20, 30, 40 years show us that our law enforcement officials can't protect us 24/7, nor were they ever expected to be able to do that. Ultimately, we have to accept the responsibility that our personal safety is our individual responsibility, bottom line. And I think oftentimes there's a faction out there who give no thought to that. And I think of people like Nancy Pelosi and other people who are anti-gun, yet they have armed security or armed, I don't know what they call them, armed personal escorts that escort them everywhere they go. They claim that no one else, like you or I, should have a gun, but they want to be able to have somebody with a gun to keep them safe.
Well, and they think they have some kind of moral high ground because they don't have guns. So instead, they hire people who have guns to protect them. The same thing was true with Rosie O'Donnell in the Million Man March, or the Million Mom March, where she was saying all these things about how terrible guns are, and then at the same time, she hires armed security to protect her from whoever might do something to her. Is she at greater risk than anybody else? Oh, maybe slightly because of her status as a celebrity, but let's face it, that's not the point. The point is, everybody is at risk at some point, including this veteran from World War II who was doing nothing more than going to the store to buy some lottery tickets. And he was attacked by these three guys, put in the hospital. Fortunately, he survived. But he lost his dentures. And, I mean, you know, that that's how hard he was hit. They knocked the dentures out of his mouth.
Terrible, terrible. And, you know, along with that incident, I have to say there were two heroic citizens. They weren't able because they didn't have the means, I guess, to intervene, but yet they secretly followed the thugs to their location, and I don't know exactly where that was, and used a cell phone to summon the police, which ultimately led to the individual's arrest. And I'm very thankful, and a considerable amount of appreciation goes out to those people for taking that matter into their own hands and at least doing that much, because they did put their well-being at risk, because the thugs, the way they are, they look to prey on anybody that can alter the way they do business. And had they known somebody was following them, and if that person would have been vulnerable, they sure would have wreaked havoc on them. I don't think there's any doubt about that particular issue.
No, I doubt seriously that there would not have been retribution if they had been, especially if they had been turned in but not caught.
Yes.
And then they found out about this. But even after having been caught, these people who turned them in are very likely wanting to stay completely out of the picture so that their name doesn't show up anywhere and that they don't become a target then for these thugs to go out and save face or to get revenge.
And there's yet another example where the laws should be changed in Illinois so that people like that within a short period of time can go out and get their concealed carry license, concealed holder's license, and be able to carry a gun for self-defense, because that is, in fact, the equalizer. The thugs don't care. It's obvious here. The thugs aren't just looking. You know, we know that a significant amount of the violent crime in Chicago is gang-related, drug-related, and it's probably youthful offenders between the ages of 16 and 25 doing it to each other. But here now we see not an isolated incident, but a fairly common incident, because a lot of the others don't get recorded, where some youthful thugs, take it out on an 87-year-old World War II veteran in broad daylight in the middle of the town with no fear of retribution. And one of the things that criminals like this or kind of act, or what motivates them, is no fear of retribution or retaliation. They don't worry about the victims, because the victims are, for all intents and purposes, helpless.
They're prey. They are defenseless. They don't have a means to, and he was walking with a cane. Why three thugs would beat up on an old man walking with a cane just because he's an easy target? Well, again, that is a justification that anyone should have to say this to defend himself. And actually, we've got somebody down at the who's asked to deal with some training because he is in that mode. He walks with a cane. That he's able to do what he needs to do at the point he needs to do it and get some extra to do base. We're going to do that and work with him to help him be able to be more confident in his ability to do what's necessary at the point it's necessary and to give him the skills that he needs so that should he be in a situation like this man was, that he is not going to be helpless, even though he may look like prey to those who are observing and say, well, here's a guy walking slow with a cane, easy target. Yeah, shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, and even broader than that, we need to work very hard to get the laws in those jurisdictions changed. Those are the laws that need changed. We don't need more gun control. We need individuals to have the ability to own and carry guns to defend themselves, because in the three cities with arguably the most stringent gun control laws in this nation, they have the highest violent crime rates involving firearms. Point, period, end of conversation. The FBI data that we've quoted on this show many, many times that you can go and reference yourself clearly states that. They'll use every other excuse in the book. They oftentimes don't even mention it. We're going to talk after the break about some comments that Mayor Bloomberg just made recently in an interview with a reporter on CNN. But the people that are anti-gun fail to recognize the realities of the communities that they themselves live in and the violence that's being perpetuated and the lack of ability of individuals to defend themselves. And it's happening time and time again.
Well, they do recognize the reality of the environment. What they fail to recognize is how their programs are perpetuating, and certainly are not, the gun control is not doing anything to slow that down, because that's not where the problem lies. So if you'd like to be part of this discussion, call the studio at 457-1290. 457-1290, 937 is the area code if you're outside our area, and we'd love to have you participate in this discussion as well. Jeff and I will be back in just a minute after this first break for the hour. And this is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on 95.7 FM and AM 1290 News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Jeff Pedro and Mark Avery for Shooting from the Hip. And if you want to get on the show, give us a call at 457-1290, 457-1290, and we'll get you on the air. I want to continue and follow up our earlier conversation with just mentioning that there was another thing that struck me during the couple weeks that I was gone, that President Obama had come out and made a comment that small business people, you didn't do it alone. Well, in our particular case, we, the few of us, did it alone with very little, if any, assistance from the federal government. And the only remotely applicable federal assistance was when we applied for a normal bank loan that was federally insured, which we did. Obviously, we paid back the loan, so we didn't have to worry about the insurance. We went to pick up the proceeds, and there was a 10% shortfall. In other words, they took 10% of what we had originally applied for, which created a shortfall in the money that we needed. And when we asked about that, they said, well, that's administrative fees that go to the federal government for the federally insured loan process. And that kind of was a little bit of a detraction. We overcame that. And for those of my loyal members who have been with us over the past 8 years, it's you that have helped us grow. And it's your efforts and your confidence in the things that we do and your ideation and your input that has made it to the gotten us to the point where we're at, and we're very appreciative of that.
And if anything, the federal control over the firearms industry makes it more difficult for an operation like ours to succeed, not that they helped us and we didn't do that. Well, we did it in spite of them, not because of anything.
That's exactly right. Now, there's some margin of truth, and I'm being a little facetious in my next explanation in what he said, in that since President Obama took office in 2008, the firearms industry has seen monthly record increases in gun sales month to month, year to year for the last 4 years. And that obviously has had a direct impact. That's also resulted in an increase in people seeking training. So even though he likes to purport that he's anti-gun, in reality, he's been his actions have resulted in a pro-gun kind of movement around the country.
Well, and it wasn't just the election. It was well before that, when it became obvious that it would be either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton who was going to be the Democrat nominee for president in 2008. Already, long before the election, gun sales had started going way up. So it's not just 2009 and forward. It really is 4 years and more before that, because we saw, when I was in 2009 at the NRA annual meeting and interviewed the president of DPMS, which makes the Black Rifles, they had said, oh, they've been booked for 18 months. They were already 18 months behind, and their big force going forward started in late 2007. So, yeah, there's been a lot more to it.
Interestingly enough, over these last 4 years, we've had some pretty significant, difficult economic times, hard times. But yet, a recently released report from the National Shooting Sports Foundation reveals that the firearms industry has experienced, get this, a 30.6% increase in job creation, a 66.5% increase in economic impact, and this is the one that's most, I think, startling, 66.5% increase in federal taxes paid by industry companies, which means there's bunches of money going through the industry, and they're paying people to work for them. They're paying way more than their fair share of the taxes, and they're doing their fair share to fuel the economy.
And so if we have – this is the situation, and we start to raise taxes, how is that going to impact availability of guns to people who are trying to buy them? The thousands of people who are waiting in line to get the next gun off the line. That can't be something that's going to be a positive impact on the production, because the more that you take out of the industry to send to government, the less that you have to do the things that the industry is trying to do, which is meet the tremendous demand from a population who recognizes that the force multiplier could be the only thing between them and disaster when the time comes.
You know, the National Shooting Sports Foundation has done a great job in taking the limited funds that they've been able to generate from the various programs that they support, that they offer over the course of a year, distributing them to small businesses like mine, and doing things like providing reimbursements for advertising and helping you promote the programs like First Shots and promoting those programs on a widespread basis to help fuel the industry. And it's kind of self-perpetuating. We take care of each other, and it's working, and it's working well, and yet there's people out there who want to see that come to an end or be very greatly limited.
And First Shots has been a tremendous program. We've been doing it now for several years. If and anybody hasn't heard of that, and especially if you're not a shooter, the National Shooting Sports Foundation First Shots program is an outstanding way to get started. All right, we need to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. We got a couple of folks waiting on the phone, so we want to get to them as soon as we get back. If you'd like to be part of the show, call the studio at 457-1290. We'll get you up on the board, and we'll get you as part of this conversation as well. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on 95.7 FM and AM 1290 News Talk Radio, WHIO.
God bless America. This is your blood brother, Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. That's what you're listening to this hour. Shooting from the Hip is brought to you by SimTrainer, and we're glad that you've joined us for this hour. If you'd like more information about SimTrainer, you can get that on our website at sim-trainer.com, and you can also call the range at 293-3914, and the staff on duty there will be happy to answer any questions you have about classes that we have coming up, or maybe our Tuesday Tactical Training League, and anything else that we can help you with in terms of firearms and getting trained. Let's go back. Let's go right out to the phones, because we've had some folks who call in. If you would like to be part of the show, you can call the studio at 457-1290, and we'll get you into the list as well. Right now, let's go out and talk to Jim, who's calling from Lima. Jim, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I appreciate you taking my call.
How can we help you?
I recently moved to Ohio from Tennessee, and where I was a deputy sheriff, and I had a concealed carry permit. I don't have a carry permit here in Ohio, but I'm wondering if my Tennessee permit will suffice or whether I need to get another one.
Well, there's two issues associated with that. First is the Tennessee question. In terms of your Tennessee concealed handgun license, that will be dependent a little bit on whether Tennessee causes your your license to be revoked when you move out of state. That's what happens in Ohio. If you become a resident of another state, your Ohio license is no longer valid. And I don't know the answer for that in Tennessee. Your Tennessee license is valid here if it's still valid in Tennessee. We do recommend that you have some other means, though, either get an Ohio license or, and I'm going to turn this over to Jeff right now, because the other question is the Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act provisions.
Jim, how long or are you actually retired from law enforcement service?
I was with the local police force in Lenoir City, Tennessee for over 10 years, and then more recently for about a year with the Sheriff's Department in Loudoun County.
Okay, the modification to the law about a year and a half ago allows you as a 10-year minimum service law enforcement officer to meet the criteria as long as you separated from service on good terms. Okay?
I did.
If you're official, are you considered retired?
Well, I didn't retire. I had been part-time with both agencies.
Okay, well, then that might be an exemption because it specifies in the law retired with a minimum of 10 years service, but you got to be entitled to a benefit of some sort, and that's what gets into the issue of certification as a law enforcement officer. But what Mark said earlier is directly on point, and I think the safest way for you to proceed, number one, check about the Tennessee provision about residency in another state, but I also think here in Ohio, once you become a resident of Ohio, you're going to be better off to get the Ohio concealed holder's license because you're now a resident of this state, and not only from the standpoint of practicality, but also legally down the road, if anything would happen, it's going to be an issue that's going to raise some issues that you don't want to necessarily have to deal with. Does that make sense?
I appreciate you. I think you're pointing me in the right direction.
Yes.
And I will check with Tennessee.
Absolutely. But I think the safest way to do that would be to just get your CHL here in the state of Ohio. And I'm sure there's plenty of places up in the Lima area that are offering the course. And then over the course of a weekend or several evenings during the week, you could get through that course. It's a minimum of 12 hours of instruction with 2 hours out on the range. And you'd be able to get your license in the county.
A 42-year-old man was thrown from the vehicle after he lost.
Well, that's the direction I'll take. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And one other thing I would add to that is that even if you do find that Tennessee will allow you to, that your license maintains valid, even if you leave the state, I would still go ahead and get your license here. All that finds out is whether or not you're legally allowed to carry between now and the time you get your Ohio license. It's less of a factor as to whether or not you should get an Ohio license. You absolutely should. Jim, thanks very much for calling the show. Let's go out and talk to Dave, who's calling from Dayton. Dave, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I think there's a lot of a misconception out there among the people that don't have a DCW about it and its use. And I think sometimes people that try to support CCW actually or what they say is counterproductive. Case in point, situations like Aurora, Colorado, I've been hearing people say that if there had been one concealed carry permit holder in that theater, the outcome would have been different. But I don't think it's people realize of what engagement is and what the factors involved. I'd like to hear your guys' viewpoint on this, and I'll hang up and listen to you.
Well, thank you very much for the comment, and I'm going to go ahead and weigh in on that. Even though I'm going to wait to discuss in much great detail, wait till the after-action report so we have the facts of what happened in Aurora, because there's a whole lot of speculation and supposition going on. But I'm of the opinion that one armed, ready, and capable person, regardless of the extremely difficult circumstances he or she might have faced in, number one, recognizing the fact that this was a violent assault on the people in that theater, and then responding in a way that would neutralize the threat, that would be extremely difficult because, as we always describe those situations, they're tense, rapidly evolving, highly stressful, and your senses can be altered to a certain degree. But I argue that at least that gave somebody a chance or an opportunity to minimize, not eliminate, but to minimize the hurt. Now, there's people who I've had this discussion with said, well, what if there were two of you and you didn't know if one of you was acting in unison with the shooter, and then there was a three-way shootout? Well, what if? Well, the bottom line is that situation as it unfolded, majority of the shooting, I'm going to guess, and again, I'm just going to throw something out there. I'd venture to guess that most of the shooting was done in 15 to 30 seconds. seconds, maybe up to a minute. And certainly in that time period, if an individual is able to maintain a position of concealment and or cover, they would be able to see that this was just a person that was out there to do a tremendous amount of harm, and they could neutralize the threat by taking a shot. And even though it was dark, again, we talk about training. Part of the responsibility of the CHL holder is to get themselves to a level of competency with their firearm to where they would be able to use it. And we at our classes tell them that most situations occur in adverse light scenarios. So therefore, taking low-level light training is going to be critical to your overall training. But that's an individual responsibility that each and every person will have to take on their own shoulders. But my personal opinion is we're better off when we have trained, ready, willing, and capable citizens who can intervene in that situation. I think Mark has several incidents, because we just talked over the weekend about a commentary on this very station last Saturday evening addressing some of those very issues.
Well, one of the things that I think needs to be understood is that although it was initially reported that the shooter was wearing body armor, that turns out not to have been the case. He was wearing a tactical vest. It gave him an opportunity to carry a lot of things easily, extra magazines and so forth, extra rounds for a shotgun. So the first argument was made that, well, if you just shot at this guy and he had body armor and adrenaline, that you would not have been able to do anything about that. He would have been able to take you out. And there's a possibility that had he been wearing body armor, that's true. I'll tell you, if you've been shot wearing body armor, that does get your attention. It changes your perspective, and he may realize that he was then no longer as invulnerable as he may have thought he was. But in this case, he was not wearing body armor, so even reasonably effective and accurate fire on him would have made a tremendous difference in the way the whole outcome would have happened. Now, one of the questions is, what about the fact that the theater chain bans carry? There's also been a story out that the city of Aurora itself does not allow concealed carry. That's a dated story. It's not true any longer. The preemption bill that passed in 2003 in Colorado eliminated city ordinances, just as it has done in Ohio. So the city ordinances that would have prohibited carry would no longer be in effect. However, the city ordinance in for Aurora does provide the force of law to signs that post "no firearms allowed," whereas the whole state does not provide any force. The state of Ohio does provides force of law. If you go past one of those signs, you're guilty of criminal trespass. That is not the case in Colorado. However, the city of Aurora does have an ordinance that says that your license to carry concealed handgun does not allow you to carry past one of those signs legally. So all of that comes together. Part of the question then becomes, did a person who went into that place carrying a firearm, would they have been prosecuted? And again, that's one of those questions that we just aren't going to know the answer to. There is some measure of discretion that's allowed in that. And we've seen several situations, and one of the classic ones was in 2007 in February in the Trolley Square Mall in Salt Lake City. There was a shooter that was there and had multiple guns and a backpack full of ammunition, and he was clearly intending to do serious harm. He had already killed five people when an off-duty cop who was having dinner with his wife cornered the shooter, had started to place fire on him, did not stop him, but made him ineffective, put him in a corner. And by the time he had been able to do that for some time, the Salt Lake City SWAT team had come in and finally ended the scenario, because he was not going to surrender. He would not have ended peacefully. The only way to take him out was to take him completely out of the picture. That was eventually what happened. But the reason only five people had been killed was because somebody who was there at the time, and in fact, this cop was carrying, but in opposition to the law of the area. I mean, the fact that the signs were on that mall that said this is a no-gun zone, that would have prohibited him from legally carrying there as well. Now, in that case, he was not prosecuted. He was deemed a hero, both in the media and in everywhere else, especially by the rest of the people who were not shot by this person. So would that have been the same case in Colorado Springs? It's really difficult to say.
Yeah, or would that have been the same case in Chicago just the other day?
Right.
As far as an individual carrying a gun that they legally couldn't possess, but they use it to defend themselves. And in, under the circumstances, I would hope to goodness that that would, in fact, be the case. But here again, we see, and all I want to mention is this is another incident where a crazed gunman goes into a target-rich environment that we create by prohibiting people with guns from being in there, and they wreak their havoc. It's happened for the last, you know, we cite one of the most infamous incidents that we, on record, that we start talking about is the Texas Tower shooting, and it's progressed all the way through to 2012 with regularity, and it's unfortunate, but it's going to continue to happen, and it's only through the actions that Mark described of spontaneous, heroic acts of people on scene that we're going to minimize, not totally eliminate the pain.
Right. Let's go back out to the phones and talk to Leon, who's called in from West Carrollton. Leon, welcome to the show.
Hello. Give Dayton Daily News credit today. They printed a good letter about guns and how you buy them and sell them and whatever, responding to one of Leonard Pitts's. And it was a good letter, and I left a copy of the newspaper at Bill Goodman's Gun and Knife show today. And it responded to the same old stories. No, you can't buy a machine gun, and what you got to do to buy an automatic machine gun, so-and-so and so-and-so, how the background checks. And I guess on Manhattan Island, they don't have to check the facts because I think the only magazines they think are pornographic are gun magazines, whether it's the type that go in the guns or the type you get off the magazine rack.
That there's certainly that possibility. There's a lot of people who are been from the New York area and have been to the New York area and have found themselves getting into a trip.
Well, speaking of the New York area, I wanted to mention one other thing that caught my attention over the last couple of weeks was a comment made by Mayor Bloomberg. And when we come back from our break, I want to go ahead and talk about that very briefly, and then we'll get out to whatever callers are left out there on the line, because I think it's directly applicable what he just said.
This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on 95.7 FM and AM 1290 News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Well, welcome back to the show. And right before the break, I mentioned that I happened to stumble across another ridiculous comment made by Mayor Bloomberg, and I'm going to paraphrase it. Mark's going to have the actual comment up on the Facebook page. But
it's already there.
In an interview with CNN's commentator Pierce Brooks, Bloomberg said that the police should go on strike until communities demand stricter gun control laws, and they should insist that we're not going to protect you, the public, until the public demand such stricter laws. And I mean, think of how ridiculous that statement was. Now, he later apparently slightly retracted his statement and qualified his statement, but the bottom line to suggest, even in a ridiculously sarcastic way, that the police should go on strike until we get stricter gun laws. If you ask policemen around the country, I think I'm safe in saying that we're not worried about the good guys. We're worried about the bad guys who, guess what, people? They don't pay attention to the law anyway, again, once said, and I just wish people would pay attention to that, but that's not on his agenda, so therefore he's not going to pay attention to what's said.
Let's go back out to the phones, and we'll talk to Larry, who's calling from Bell Fountain. Larry, welcome to the show.
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I need a question answered about going into supermarkets. I've been doing it for 2 years, and there's no signs on the door of no guns. But now this one store bought the liquor store business and put it in a private room. Am I still allowed to go in there?
Yes, as long as they're not...
Not in the liquor store, though.
No, you can still carry in the liquor store. That's not a question. As long as it's not a place that is, you know, selling alcohol in open container and you're consuming, you're okay. The law changed. This wouldn't have even affected a liquor store. It only affected a place that was selling it for consumption on premises before that law went into effect in September 30th of last year. Then you would have not been able to go in there. But that doesn't apply anymore. The fact that they have a liquor license, even if that is what they have, even if they do have a Class D license, it doesn't prohibit you from going in there. Thanks very much for calling the show. Larry, let's go out real quickly to Bob, who's calling from Centerville. We just got about a minute left, Bob. Thanks for calling the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call. A couple of items on that shooting in Aurora, Colorado. That is the Rave cinema chain there. And, of course, we have Rave.
No, it's not the Rave cinema chain.
It's not Rave?
No, it's not the Rave cinema. It is, I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. Cinemark is the name of their cinema. And they have the Century and a couple others. But, no, Rave is different. The Rave Cinema
is,
here.
Well, it's a nationwide chain. They're here
is.
In the Dayton area.
Correct.
And I know that, you know, the Doors have got decal signage preventing or telling you that, you know, that no weapons are permitted.
That's not true now. As of the last time I was at the Rave Cinema in the Green, that was in late June. And my daughter took me there for Father's Day, and they did not have any signage posted there now. We're out of time. We can talk about this another show. Thanks very much for being part of the show. Stay tuned for There Is a Season with Bob and Gloria. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on 95.7 FM and AM 1290. News Talk Radio, WHIO.